This is Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Richard Wollstonecroft, Count Fosco, and Pilliter. We're going to be discussing the Alex Proyas film, Dark City. Great talking to you guys.
Nice talking to you.
Nice talking to you.
Good morning from Australia.
And I watched the film for the first time last night, and I was quite impressed. Richard, to start things off, you're a personal friend of Alex Proyas. Can you talk about your connection to him?
Well, I mean, I don't know him like personally. I mean, I'm Facebook friends with him, and we've chatted a bit on Facebook and a tiny bit in private. And basically, just you know, I mean, obviously, I've been aware of his work. You know, he's a major Australian filmmaker. And very influential, really. And he's almost like the Australian Peter Jackson. And the projects he does is often with Hollywood and large budgets, you know, I don't know what his budgets are, but I imagine they're somewhere between 50 and 100 million for some of the bigger projects he's done. So, you know, I mean, that's how I've got to know him, I guess, through Facebook in the last couple of years. And I think, you know, obviously, I've been aware of him, and I imagine through my own rambling, he's probably aware of me a little bit and some of my interests and, you know, the fact that I run the Melbourne Underground Film Festival. And, you know, he seems to have his heart in the right place. He has really good taste. And, I mean, that film, Dark City, is extremely influential, I think. I mean, one of the first things you should say about it is that, like, it's almost got a very similar plot to The Matrix, and it came out a year before. So,
yeah, I mean, a lot of people even accused The Matrix of stealing the plot.
Well, I'm not sure. Maybe The Matrix was in development for years or something, and there was just a similar idea, like a zeitgeist idea. But I think, you know, it's...
You could also even make the case that The Matrix ripped off Plato's cave allegory.
Well, yes. And
people talk about ripping this off, but, I mean, everything's, like, constantly influencing other things, like going back to that Plato's cave allegory.
Yeah, and they are different films. I mean, The Matrix, even though it has a similar kind of idea of a kind of meta-reality, it's got a lot more guns, more like an action film, and, you know, like, you know, it does various, you know, I mean, and I think Proyas is more interested in, you know, like the kind of almost gothic kind of neo-noir thing he had going on there, which was very original at the time. I'd never seen a film like it, you know, with the, like the... What do they call the guys who are in the black hats? They call them the Others, is that right?
Yeah, the Others. They're kind of like the strange aliens.
Mr. Hand, Richard O'Brien from the Rocky Horror Picture Show, Bruce, Bruce Spence from a lot of Australian films. He was in Mad Max 2. He plays one of the, I think it was Mr. Will, I think is the character's name. And there are a number of other interesting Australian actors who pop up in the film. So I heard about the film being made in Sydney, funnily enough, in the late 90s, because I was doing the Hellfire Club up there. And, you know, I remember sort of thinking this sounded really interesting. And I remember Kiefer Sutherland being cast in it. And, you know, I think for a film that was shot in a studio, it's got a very interesting look. It's quite meticulously done. And I think one of Proyas's great long suits is that, you know, he's a real... visual stylist, like, even in the way the cinema has gone, you know, if you look at the filmmakers like David Fincher and, you know, where the look of the film is very important, you know, I think, you know, he's one of the original pioneers of that. I mean, it was called the cinema of look. I think it was connected to, who's the filmmaker that made The Fifth Element? What's his name?
Luc Besson. Besson.
It's interesting what you were saying about, I mean, I think it's mostly on a set. I don't think the city, I mean, parts of it are computer generated. For the most part, it's on a set. But the way these sets work is, I remember when we were talking about, like, Nicholas Vince when he acted on Hellraiser, how that whole giant labyrinth in the film was, it appears massive, but was actually quite small in reality. And it would be interesting to see, like, how that set looked when they were making it. I mean, it's really remarkable. But, I mean, it looks massive in the film, but it's interesting to see, like, how it would have looked when they were making it.
And the storyline is basically, I think, more kind of disturbing in a way in Dark City. Because, in a way, The Matrix, at least, you know, opens the idea that you can free yourself from The Matrix. and return to reality and possibly somehow build a real human community on Earth again or something. But like with Dark City, I mean, spoilers, you know, you're off in space on some floating, you know, like flat Earth kind of device. And like, you know, you clearly are no longer connected to the Earth at all. And, you know, and exactly what is real and what isn't is very strange in that film. And I think that's
there's
the point
also of some parallels even to like The Truman Show. I mean, The Truman Show is more of a lighthearted comedy, but it is sort of that theme where they have the Jim Carrey's character come in, and he thinks he's living in the world the whole life, but he's in this like soundstage.
Well, that film is you know, that's Peter Weir, another Australian director. You know, that film it's got comedy elements, but it's definitely a serious film, The Truman Show. It's not a happy message, and it's obviously a warning about reality television and about you know, just the way we are all watching ourselves, even through all this kind of Facebook bullshit.
And that film, I mean, I remember seeing it as in theaters as a kid, but it came out like before reality TV and social media, so it was ahead of its time. I think it was like maybe 96, but I forget.
It came out in 98, I think. Yeah, it came out in 98. So, you know, I think, you know, it's kind of a late, it's got a kind of millennial kind of, you know, there's a bit of a kind of millennial panic. I don't know, there's a slight apocalyptic feel around that time. People thought the Y2K was going to destroy all computers, which of course, you know, is, you know, is about as much bullshit as climate change. But climate change seems to have more legs. Yeah, it's kind of, I think it sums up a lot of kind of fears. And I mean, look, I think, you know, to make the obvious point, this is something I did notice when I watched it at the cinema, when I saw it, when it came out, is that it's clearly a metaphor for like what's called within the alt-right, kind of globalist cabal, or, you know what I mean? Like these secret kind of mega, kind of powerful people who kind of manipulate reality from behind the scenes, you know, and the sense that, you know, I mean, you were even seeing it with Trump, you know, to some extent, that all sides of politics end up sort of doing what the globalists want, even though there is clearly some resistance now and some true resistance that's actually succeeding. So, you know, maybe Mr. Hand and, you know, the others can be defeated.
And this goes back to kind of the theme in The Ghost in the Shell that we were talking about, how in The Ghost of Shell, they strip her of her identity or memory. And I know people have also compared this film to Ghost in the Shell, because what the others do is they switch around people's memories. So someone wakes up randomly and they don't know who they are. But people just sort of assume it's the norm and they don't really question it. So their memories are erased and a new memory is implanted.
That's another thing that makes this film particularly disturbing. I mean, even in The Matrix, you yourself were not fake. You know what I mean? Like, in this, it's clear that your memories, you know what I mean, and the things you consider yourself, you know, is not you. You know what I mean? Like, it's something that they're injecting you with in this, you know, I mean, that the others bring you in. And, I mean, this is all very kind of – and why the others are doing it is very strange. They seem to be – on some kind of quest to study the human soul, but this seems kind of, you know, obtuse. And maybe they're just sort of control freaks. I don't know. But it's a very disturbing film. I remember thinking it was an important film when it came out and that it wasn't, like, as appreciated for what a true kind of masterpiece it is. And seeing it again on Blu-ray.
I think it's far superior to The Matrix.
I think it's, you know, it's more disturbing and it's dealing with darker themes, you know, where nothing is real. And, you know, but still, it's, you know, he does appear to liberate himself in the end to some kind of reality where he begins to kind of tune, as they say, like the others who control the reality there. So that's the kind of Neo thing, you know, where you sort of free yourself from the fake reality or the cave, you know. That we all live in. So maybe that is the hopeful message of it.
With Count Fosco, you can comment on that, but remember we did that show talking about kind of these different like retro futurist aesthetics, like steampunk, decopunk, and cyberpunk, and this is definitely a sort of like, it has aspects, it's film noir, has aspects of like the film Metropolis, but it's that very kind of a deco punk, like 1930s to 40s, like retro futurist aesthetic.
It definitely feels that way. One thing that I would notice is that I can't really place them, though. I mean, it seems, I would assume that they're somewhere, they have been abducted from somewhere in the eastern United States, but I can't really tell. Not from the characters.
Yeah, like it's kind of like these aliens, like, they study our society, and they sort of take these different styles. Like, maybe it's a little bit of this city, a little bit of New York, a little bit of, like, Victorian, maybe a little bit of the Victorian era, kind of the gothic aesthetic, some kind of like decopunk,
you know, cyberpunk. Especially kind of interesting what I learned about Dark City was actually from a cameo or a talk in the comic series Johnny the Homicidal Maniac by Jonan Vasquez. There was this obsession in the mid-90s from artists like Sam Keith or Alex Party or Jonan Vasquez. There was an obsession with the goth art style, and if you think of The Crow, also directed by Proyas, that was by James O'Barr, and you take a look at some of his art, there was this grim, dark, edgy, you know, black on white canvas, hardcore stuff that was, you know, that sounded like kind of juvenile.
Are you thinking of the scene where one of the characters is drawing those crazy spirals?
That too, and just the movie set in general, it definitely comes from a 90s energy of this angry post-Gen X, you know, late grunge, or at least in the 80s, you know, there was this commercialization of the quote-unquote goth character in the 90s, and that was a very big thing, and these kind of dweebs, which you might consider proto-social justice warriors who painted their nails black and dyed their hair black, you know, these nerds who had revenge fantasies about shooting up their schools, leading up to Columbine, of course. But, you know, films like Dark City, I guess in some respect, is that you know, emotional turmoil or some kind of feeling could be translated in that goth world, which we don't see now because I think today everything's been pussified, or at least twee, from Adventure Time or being puppy cat. Now everything's cutesy. I think that generation just grew the fuck up and basically now, like, have kids, and they're basically, I don't know. It's an interesting phase, though, because we don't see that edgy stuff. Everybody has a trigger warning now, right? You can't even talk about these old school 90s goth stuff.
Oh yeah, definitely. Pillater, would you say there's a comparisons to Akira? I mean, I've actually heard that made as well.
That's interesting. I looked at more as this surreal thing, like the like you were just saying, the Art Deco, or the just looking at James O'Barr's old art, you know, I get this feeling of just like edgy kind of, was it nihilistic, Nine Inch Nails, you know, the typical 90s moody mentality of teens angst. But it certainly brings, there is that nostalgia for it. But for the Akira part, I always think of something that there's Eastern, you know, but I really can't see the Eastern part in, I'm thinking of another film called Naked by Mike Leigh.
Oh, I think the comparison wasn't the aesthetic so much, but the characters, the others, they're comparing those to Akira.
Oh, yeah, I was thinking of, like, some kind of Dune character from, like, David Lynch, or some kind of back to Lynch, or some kind of edgy.
I think a big influence on Dark City, oddly enough, is probably Doctor Who. The characters of the others really resemble some of the better episodes of Doctor Who, where there was, like, a strange group of people up to no good, or strange alien race. And I think it also, you were like, in relation to the gothic thing you're talking about, you know, the film shows a kind of high level of alienation, obviously, and is almost like a portrait of kind of, you know, contemporary, you know, young people in that era, you know, reaching an almost impossible level of alienation where there's like nowhere back from. They're floating off into space. It's so intense. So, I mean, you know, I think it's a powerful film of its time, and it holds up very well. And it also, I think, is a groundbreaking film. And in a sense, a lot of the, you know, Christopher Nolan, for example, his work resembles, you know, what he did with that film Inception is very similar, I think, to what Alex was doing with Dark City. And there are not many films like Dark City before Dark City, so in a sense it's quite original.
Could you say there's this kind of a Nietzschean theme of a man becoming this sort of godlike figure, in the sense that he defeats the others in the end and he recreates his own new utopian society?
I think so. I think so. I mean, I'm not sure what Alex's politics are, and I wouldn't speak for him on that behalf. But I mean, this, I've had a few conversations. I think he came from the background of punk. So, you know, I mean, if you know Pete, I mean, probably from the same milieu of someone like Nick Cave. Or so, I mean, you know, they tend to have a kind of anarchic kind of punk attitude to things. Sometimes they have an interest in some right-wing ideas. Sometimes they have an interest in, you know, left-wing and social studies. So, you know, they tend to have a, you know, their own kind of, you know, mix, and they tend to like things connected with some elements of anarchism, you know.
Well, it doesn't have to be explicitly ideological. It's just this one man, and he starts out as this outsider, and he goes in this struggle, and then in the end he wins, and then he kind of gets to restructure society the way he wants to see it. Like, he basically, like, there's that place he...
In a sense,
the place called Shell Beach, which he nostalgicizes from his memory, and it never existed, but then he ends up creating it.
He ends up creating
Robert.
It. That is the real power of the film right there, in the sense the thing that didn't exist, that itself was a false memory, he ended up creating. In a way, it's a metaphor also for what, you know, I mean, again, to relate it back to the alt-right a little bit, it's sort of what the alt-right might, you know, make America great again. People say America's never been great, but... Maybe if one was able to really realize a nationalist kind of utopia, maybe you could make something great. You could actually make Shell Beach exist.
Yeah, it is a very kind of real place. It's a very idealistic place. But the Shell Beach in the film, it has a very kind of a like East Coast, like how you imagine like Cape Cod looking.
Oh, really? Yes, yes. You know, I mean, obviously it looks a bit like New York, the city itself, or maybe Chicago. I'm not sure what city it's meant to be kind of replicating. And obviously it's not contemporary to the 90s. It's got an almost kind of 50s feel to it. And it's also, I mean, you know, like the opening shot where there's that light in that green room with the bath and the fish. And, you know, there's a lot of very interesting visual things going on in that film constantly.
Oh, yeah. I remember that scene, the bar with... that weird aquarium. Pill Eater, remember we had a Thomas Rinaldi on, and we were talking about those, like, bulb signage, but you see a lot of those bulb signage, animated bulb signage in the film, in the fish, like, the fish aquarium place. Then you also see that animated billboard, and then you have, like, the kind of 1940s-style automat, so it's kind of cool how he plays with the signage.
I just remembered we're talking about Myst or Riven from the series, but those are some old 90s games. But the ideal that there's an atmospheric that you get lost in art and you interact with art. And relating us to Dark City, I can think Dark City could be a certain place that people want to role play in. And when I mean role play, I'm talking about role playing games. You know, somebody will have a source book and say, you know, people make up these backgrounds or sort of pseudo-science fiction behind them, kind of like what Dune is, where you can just read Dune a lot and then pick up these themes and be like, it's a different world, but it's not like ours. You get obsessed with that kind of aesthetic. And, you know, I think Dark City has certainly people got look in that world as like, oh, this world's so cool, because it really can't be explained in words. It only can be really explained in pictures.
Yeah, that's really the irony of, like, portraying a dystopia in film, because we were talking about these different films like Ghost in the Shell, even Blade Runner, and obviously this film. And obviously, I mean, a real dystopia I would think of would be, like, your typical sort of American city that's, like, full of Walmarts. But if you're going to create a dystopian film, to intrigue the audience, you have to... portrays something that's visually intriguing. So it's kind of ironic how all these like dystopian films create these really aesthetically pleasing societies.
Yeah, the film that he made before that was The Crow, and that also had an interesting look. That, I mean, I think Dark City almost continues on from the kind of look of The Crow a little bit. And obviously, there was a kind of tragedy on the film The Crow. The death of the lead actor, Brandon Lee, and I think that had a personal effect. I mean, I'd never spoken to Alex about it, but I remember reading articles. You know, he was, you know, obviously, you know, when someone like the lead actor dies on the set of your own film, it is upsetting, and, you know, because you would think, oh, could I have done things differently, and blah, 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 you know. So, you know, I think that might add to the kind of darkness of the piece, you know what I mean? And that he was sort of dealing with a kind of, you know,
well, I think he turned The Crisis into, you know, probably his greatest work, I think. I also watched Knowing just a couple of days ago. Well, that was a film he made in the late 90s in Melbourne, but it's set in America about, you know, like a kind of like, you know, one of those time capsules revealing like a kind of note that is, you know, basically set every major event, you know, from September 11 onto whatever, you know, and again, deals in notions of conspiracy, and there are people in it who are a little more like angels, but are a bit like the others in this film. So it seems to be a theme that he likes to go back to. And, you know, I think it's a, I mean, you know, reality, for all science wants to tell us about it, it does feel manipulated. It does feel as if, you know, it's not just random chance, the things that are happening, you know what I mean, often. And, you know, so many, our lives are filled with so many meaningful coincidences and synchronicity. You know, someone like what Carl Jung talks about. This just doesn't seem random.
Count Fosco, do you want to comment on the theme of portraying a dystopia in film and how it ends up becoming, because as a filmmaker, you want to create something that is enticing and ends up becoming kind of ironically a utopia?
Well, everything that I guess other people would call like a dystopia kind of seems a utopia to me. So I don't know if I'm really the one to ask about that. But what I do think is that it's interesting that his utopia basically involves like a very simple pleasure, walking along the beach. And a lot of people might not really see that as just their utopia.
It's basically the same society, but basically bringing back the sun, recreating kind of the scene in the ocean. Then there's kind of that very ending scene where he meets up with Jennifer Connelly and they walk. Well, she was his wife, but like he gets a chance to kind of start over from scratch, and they meet up like they just met, and that's basically the final scene where the main character and Jennifer Connelly go off to a shell beach together.
Right. Something I did want to mention, though, I think earlier someone said that it seems that he had defeated the Strangers, which is this group of aliens. I have to wonder, though, did he really defeat the Strangers? I mean, just as a plot point, at the very end, I mean, Mr. Hand, he's still around. It's just the Strangers don't have their collective identity anymore. Most of them seem to have disappeared. But the one guy who was kind of imprinted with his own memories is still there, almost like a second him.
Mr. Hand, towards the end, he survives, but he's like dying. He's basically defeated.
Yeah, I mean, Mr. Hand is interesting too because, in a sense, the others have a kind of element like the Borg, in the sense they're a collective consciousness. And it seems when Mr. Hand injects the fake consciousness, but at least the singular one of Murdoch, into himself, somehow he changes. And maybe actually does discover what it means to be human, even though he starts going around killing people. But it's interesting, a complex film, and it's mysterious. And I think that's what's that. You know, I mean, Alex Proyas's production company called Mystery Clock Cinema, and you know, there's that giant clock in it, and you know, the film itself is a kind of clockwork mystery. And I think, you know, that is a metaphor for what he's doing for it.
I was just looking up. On the side, classic goth comics, and it seems like some of these goth comics we've been talking, not the comics itself, but these subjects previously on episodes of This Dark Truth we were talking about, such as not Hellraiser, but there's another one called Hellblazer that was I kind of remember that one, or we were Batman. Didn't we have something about, I don't think we had something about Batman, but I know there's been this talk since of Richard Spencer and of Countercurrents. There's always been this talk, and of Jonathan Bowden. There's this talk about Arkham Asylum by Grant Morrison and David McKean version. That's an interesting book because it definitely has this weird aesthetic that would help this goth thing of the 90s, but it's interesting if you think of Dark City's time when it came out and some of these art appearing in the late 80s, you know, it takes 10 years and you put it in film aesthetic, you have this, I guess the new word we're talking about is grimdark, you know, that is a word reserved for Warhammer 40K. It now has become
Grimdark.
Yes, Grimdark. It's been reserved for Warhammer 40K, but now that kind of does describe that old, I guess, quote-unquote, goth art scene, and now it just means edgy, black, hate everything, you know, you're kind of hardcore. But there is, it's interesting because I'm looking at this right now, and The Crow is probably one of the most known goth comics. It's just well-known because of the franchise and because of all this together from music, aesthetics, culture, that generation. We could be talking about Vaporwave and be talking about Japan of the 80s and how everything's pink and futuristic and anime. Then again, we could be talking about America in the 80s where you have black hair, goth arena rock, and just like makeup and you look like Kiss or something. We talk about death. And that is an aesthetic of its own. I just think the goth aesthetic is dead, and now it's been pretty much replaced with like Lottie Dottie, lollipops, rainbows, unicorns, and bronies. I don't know what has happened to that scene now.
I mean, there still are goth people around, and there are many other sub-genres. And obviously, when you go to somewhere like Japan, you know, I mean, one of the great things about Japan is it's, you know, Promethean nature to just continually kind of replicate these bizarre sub-movements that actually are kind of exciting, interesting at times, at least colorful. And, you know, I think, I think that... it would be fair enough to say that something like Dark City is sort of connected to a kind of goth connection, which has a certain kind of level of nihilism, and again has a kind of punk connection with it. You know, something like the band, like the Damned, or something like that, had a both kind of punk and goth kind of feel to it. So, you know, I think I was just really impressed, you know, by watching it again, and you know, I think it's one of the, you know, would have to go into your top 20 films of the 90s, or you know, top 10 films.
Another thing is some of the scenes remind me of like Edward Hopper paintings. Do you kind of get that?
Absolutely, yeah, definitely. You know, Edward Hopper, and you know, kind of it's like a neo-noir, and it's the art direction of it is superb. Like it's they're all sets. He's not using anything real as far as I can see. So he's recreated this whole kind of like 1950s. It's almost got almost David Lynch quality to it. You know what I mean? Like the level of detail, you know, in it, in the various, you know, like just if you, you know, the various places just have, you know, very distinct aesthetics that look sort of similar to things that were from the 50s, but are kind of list kind of like, you know, altered slightly and, you know, or like tuned. And, you know, it's just really a really clever piece of filmmaking. Roger Ebert was a huge fan of it, you know what I mean? He championed it. And, you know, a number of critics, I think, realized how good it was. I mean, not everybody, because it's received a few negative reviews as well, but still, I mean, you know, anything that is important should, you know, upset a few people, I think.
I've watched this a couple of times now, and another character that really intrigued me was this character, Walensky, who also, I guess you could say he wakes up. Or yes.
Was Walensky the guy who he runs into in the subway and then he jumps in front of the subway train while the train heads off to it pretends to go off to Shell Beach?
Yes, but even before that, the interesting thing about Walensky is he figures it out, but he doesn't have Murdoch's powers. I think he's more of a stand-in for most of us. Like, we may as well be crazy.
He's kind of a regular guy, but there was a glitch in the system, and they failed to put everyone to sleep, and he managed to somehow discover it. But I think, yeah, he was also a police detective.
Yes, and it's played by the famous Australian actor Colin Friels, who's, you know, kind of a, you know, often plays kind of like the everyman kind of character, and, you know, has done a lot of work here down under, and he's using an American accent there. But, you know, I think, yeah, that is definitely an important part. And, yeah, I think represents, you know, the average person who might be red-pilled, but, you know, it's sort of almost powerless to do anything about it. As the, you know, others seem to still be tuning everything to their, you know, to their, you know, chosen reality, you know.
As far as her character goes, Jennifer Connelly, the thing that most struck me was the way her song just kind of just signals almost an unconscious awareness of the others, which I think in the movie they're only ever called strangers, I think, by the doctor, because he doesn't know who they are, where they come from. I don't know if it's interesting to me that they all go through their lives and they don't question fundamental things like where is Shell Beach, and I've taken people there 1,000 times, but I don't know where it is.
It's always night. I mean, it seems that constant reality seems to be from like dusk until midnight, and or you know, like when it gets dark, and like it seems like it's never in day, which is, I guess, where the title for the film comes from. So, yeah, I mean, obviously, all these characters are living in a repetitive reality that this keeps repeating, which again is you know, a metaphor for something like, you know, a globalist capitalist world, but it could also be applied to something like communism, you know, like the USSR. And the kind of grey artificial reality that was created under the Soviet communist bloc, that, you know, it was extremely oppressive. I mean, I've toured some elements of Eastern Europe, and, you know, and it was just really like living in 1984, and, you know, like it's, you know, quite in Czechoslovakia. I looked into, like, you know, I did the tour of the you know, like the USSR of, you know, when it was under the you know, under the rule, and it was just hideous.
The allegory that most struck me about this movie was not so much Plato's cave, but actually the ship of Theseus problem. I mean, in regards to their personal identities, when you really think about it, you have to wonder, do any of these people really have an identity of their own? If they're just endlessly replaced, do they bear any responsibility to the memories that have been injected into them, presumably from someone else?
I think that is a real issue with the film. You know, I mean, you know, exactly who these people are, what are their real memories? You know, it shows a level of an extreme level of deracination, an extreme level of alienation. I mean, it's as I said, it's so intense. You know, that old saying, you can't go home again. You know what I mean? Like, in the reality of Dark City, there is no returning home. There's only the possibility of creating some new reality, maybe based on, you know, realizing some delusion you might have.
I think I was reading online somewhere that, I forget where I read this, but someone was actually complaining about the city, about Dark City being perhaps a bad movie for schizophrenics to watch. almost as if I forget which article I was browsing, but it sounded like they were worried that they might get too involved in John Murdoch's delusion, or I guess, as we know, the audience, his reality.
Yeah, I mean, it clearly resembles a lot of the symptoms of schizophrenia. I mean, obviously, I don't suffer from schizophrenia, so I can't say, but, you know, I've heard what people experience with that. So, yeah, again, that's another kind of powerful thing about the film, is that, you know, I mean, is the main character simply utterly insane? I mean, you know, maybe the whole film is, you know, maybe the others are a fiction, you know what I mean? Maybe he's just mentally ill, and, you know, his reality is all we see in the film, you know. So, I mean, you know, I think it has levels, and, you know, that's what makes it interesting.
What do you think about the role that the psychiatrist plays in the film? He's sort of the one that, he's mysterious at first, but he's the one who exposes the main character to the truth.
Well, he's a collaborator, clearly. He's a collaborator with the others. He knows about them, and he imprints everybody, it seems. I mean, he must be a busy bloke. You know, there seems to be a lot of people in that city. But obviously, there may have been someone else doing it as well. But, like, yeah, I mean, exactly what Kiefer Sutherland was doing, I have no idea. I remember even thinking that when I first saw it. I said, what the fuck was Kiefer Sutherland up to? But he is clearly in league with this reality, and in the sense, like, how could you not be? You know what I mean? Like, and I've almost had this kind of argument with, you know, I mean, if someone as powerful as Trump, you know, can't defeat the globalists, how the fuck are we going to do it? You know what I mean? Like, you know, it's like, you know, it almost, you know, like, you know, again, it creates this kind of almost nihilistic kind of portrait of, you know, contemporary reality, you know, which, yeah, has a kind of, you know, goth kind of, you know, angsty kind of nihilism, you know?
Yeah.
Richard, something that occurred to me to maybe ask you, I don't know if you should ask Alex this, but I'd like to know how much thought was actually put into the naming of these others, because when you think about the names that they're all given, things like Mr. Hand, Mr. Book, Mr. Yes. Wall, Mr. Quick. I almost, I'm almost thinking in biblical terms or almost kind of religious terms when I hear all of these names, like books, bells, smells, death. I'd like to know how much thought he really put into that, because it does summon a certain feeling to me.
Yeah, I think it's very distinctive, and I think it's got a menacing kind of quality to it, and I think it's quite deliberate, you know, using these kind of words to describe, you know, Mr. This, Mr. That, you know, and there appear to be no women who were others either, as far as I could see.
Yeah,
and they resembled I don't know. I mean. I don't know what you'd compare them to, but I mean that fantastic English actor who was like the leader of them is Ian Richardson.
Yes.
I mean, he is spectacular. He's an old Shakespearean.
He plays in the original House of Cards, right?
Exactly. You know, he's an Shakespearean actor, and I mean, he was playing that deadly serious, that part. Like, he was really into it, you could tell, and he gave a very good performance, I think. So, you know, I mean, it was, you know. And just the fact, you know, pulling off a film like that, can you imagine pitching that to a Hollywood studio? I mean, how the fuck do you do that? You know what I mean? Like, that is like, you know, a miracle in itself, like creating Shell Beach right there. You know, how do you get a Hollywood studio to make such a strange film? You wouldn't do it now. I mean, I think the fact that Crow was successful and his first film, you know, was a kind of a bit of a cult hit down under. And, you know, and he was just, you know, basically given carte blanche based on his talent to do something. It says that the budget was only $27 million. That's extraordinary. You know, that's really quite cheap for a film like that.
Yeah, sometimes, like, the mid-range budget films end up being a lot better. Sometimes these films with these massive budgets of, like, a quarter billion or almost, some cases, almost half a billion, like, they have almost too much special effects. They kind of lose that quality.
Yeah, I agree. I think, you know, Hollywood has definitely gone into some cycle where, you know, like all these Avengers films, a lot of these superhero films, even that Suicide Squad, like, where at the end you just have this giant CGI action sequence. You're fighting some basic video game, you know, where it's just, you know, all these Morpheus creatures. And it has no sense of, no sense of peril or no sense of danger. Because, you know, the extent that these creations are real. I mean, with something like The Others and Mr. Hand, these people had a sense of threat. The Bruce Spence character, I mean, you know, there was something really creepy about them, you know. And, you know, there was a sense of danger to them. And then they revealed they could fly, and you had no idea what their full power was in the beginning. And, you know, it's very interesting.
And what makes this film successful is the sense of mystery. There's this like gradual build-up. I mean, you don't find out everything till the end, but throughout the film they reveal more and more clues. I mean, obviously a lot of films are like that, but I think some films reveal like too much too soon.
Yeah, I watched the director's cut. I mean, and then I read a little bit online how it was different from the theatrical cut. I do think I like the director's cut better.
Oh, yeah, I saw the theatrical cut. I noticed when I was getting it, looking at it on my Apple TV, you could only rent the theatrical cut. And you had to buy the director's cut. How was the director's cut different overall?
Well, I think, it's got an exploding narrative of Kiefer Sutherland at the beginning. And it's just got things that are, you know, that just make it a little bit more obvious what's going on and kind of don't allow the audience to kind of go along with it. But I think it's definitely a powerful enough film that you can allow audiences just to go with it. And that, you know, you pretty much know what's going on, you know, at the end, even if it is a bit kind of out there. You know what I mean? I mean, and he actually did something similar in the film The Gods of Egypt, which is strange. I mean, he definitely likes the idea of almost floating reality. I mean, in the sense, which of course is the planet Earth, but in the film Gods of Egypt, which was, you know, panned by a lot of critics as, you know, being, you know, what's it called, white casting, because, you know, all the main characters were like, you know, Joel Edgerton and that guy from, you know, 300, what's his name again? Jared Butler. That film was, you know, because the Egyptians were being played by, like, you know, Anglo-Saxon actors and Australian actors But,
I thought Alex Proyas, wasn't he originally from Egypt?
Alex is definitely has Egyptian heritage. I think his father is Egyptian, and I'm not sure, maybe his mother as well.
And but he lived all his life in Australia, I think. And but yeah, I think he has that connection, and that, you know, I mean, I saw in Thailand, and I mean, there were all these amazing kind of like, you know, giant statues they were building there for the film. I think it looked really interesting, and obviously I've been a huge fan of Proyas's work, so I went and saw it at like a deluxe, like, you know, where they come out and massage, you know, give you free popcorn over there. I saw it in this, you know, giant, what's it called, gold class cinema over there, and I was really blown away by it. And you know, again, he used the idea of this, you know, that Egypt has this myth that, you know, like, you know, the world was riding on the back of Ra or like a god. And, you know, at one stage in the film, you go underneath the world and there's Geoffrey Rush playing the god Ra, who's like the, you know, basically maintaining the universe, you know. And it's a very, again, you know, floating reality. And, you know, I mean, what are the others? Are they the globalists? Are they a kind of metaphor for a globalist communist? Or are they a metaphor for like gods or aliens? You know what I mean? Like, this is, you know, it's definitely reaching to, you know, these high levels of metaphysics that I always find really interesting and worth, you know, engaging with.
And that's the beauty of art, whether it's cinema, literature, or even visual art. I mean, you can communicate a strong message, but you don't have to be totally explicit about it.
Exactly. Yeah, I think so. And just you know, a really great film, and more power to him. You know, I mean, I think at one stage he was going to make what's the name of that famous poem by Prometheus Unbound?
Prometheus by Lord Byron.
No. I can't believe it. It's the one set in hell. It's a famous poem. I have to look it up. Milton, by John Milton.
Right. Okay.
Paradise
Lost. Yeah, he was going to make Paradise. And, you know, which is, I mean, no one's ever attempted to do that. I mean, that would have been absolutely extraordinary. And he says he actually has an animated film, like, you know, like a visual animated film of what he wanted to do, which he actually, you know, created to show to the studios, you know, before they went ahead and funded it, which he actually says is completed. And I said, you should just chuck it online. I mean, he was very close to doing that. I think, you know, I mean, that would have been incredible. I mean, maybe that's something he could still do one day. I mean, you know, that filmmaker Terry Gilliam has been trying to make the Cervantes novel, I think, for about 30 or 40 years now. And every time he does it, it's like he falls through. He's done it like about 8 or 9 times where he's tried to start it. So some things really are a struggle. And, you know, but I think something like a John Milton adaptation would be extraordinary. By someone like Alex, it would just be extraordinary.
Count Fosco, is there anything else you'd like to add?
No, I can't think of anything right now, but it definitely made me think about some things, this film.
Yeah, and I think that's what good cinema does. And, it, you know, I mean, it's. I know that from, you know, being a friend on Facebook, Alex does have a certain kind of point of view. He rails against, I guess, the conformity of, you know, Hollywood cinema now, the way it's, a lot of it's very safe, the way they're constantly doing sequels. Critics appear to annoy him. You know, because I think he's someone who's been severely critiqued over the years, you know, and I mean, I don't mean people like us who are just kind of bullshitting, you know, but I mean people who are professional and who make it their lives to slate films or blah, 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 you know, I mean, he seems to often have animus towards, I guess, you know, negative critics who, you know, couldn't make a film if their life depended on it. Because, you know, making a film is hard. I mean, I tell you that as a filmmaker. Yeah, Ben Wheatley said something. He did that film High Rise recently. You know, he said making a semi-decent film, even a semi-decent one, it's actually a really hard thing to do. I mean, it's a complex. It's definitely the most complex art form on the planet because it involves photography, acting, you know, theater, writing, music. You know, I mean, so yeah. It's almost the kind of Wagnerian Gesamtkunstwerk. You know, total artwork, because it just involves just about every other artwork, even things like sculpture and, I mean, paintings appear, you know, I mean, so it is a very, you know, so when you see someone who's doing things very well, they are a very high artistic level of achievement.
And I think one more thing I will add about the film is the opening scene is very successful in setting up that sense of mystery where he finds himself in the apartment. That's like before he gets suspected as being a murderer, where he's in the bathtub, and then the scene where he drops a goldfish, and then he gets that strange call from the doctor, and he's like, "You got to leave immediately."
Yeah, it's fascinating, and I do think that the film visually has affected like the film Seven by David Fincher was a real influence. It was one of the first films that almost had this look, like the actual tone of it, like it was almost like it had a kind of sepia tone to the whole film, and I think Dark City has that as well. And both Seven and Dark City are one of the two first mainstream, larger budget Hollywood films I've seen sort of create this, where the whole film has a kind of particular feel and look to it. So, I think it's, again, one of the things that makes it so interesting. And I think, everyone in the alt-right should go out and see it, and everyone who's not in the alt-right, it's just one of those important films to see and, discover Proyas's work, because it's really interesting. Gods of Egypt, I thought was fucking fantastic. A lot of people didn't like him. I thought it was fucking really good. He's never made a bad film, as far as I know. I've never seen him make a bad one. So, and that's very hard to say about many filmmakers outside of people like maybe David Lynch or Herzog or Kubrick. So, he's in the rarefied air of the highest achievement.
We are at the end of the show. Dark City is really a remarkable film. I mean, it's one of the top... I'd say I'd probably conclude it's like one of the top 10 mainstream films, and definitely, like as you said, David Lynch, Alex Proyas, I mean they're up there as probably like the top. As far as mainstream film directors go, they're probably like the most innovative. I would like to thank Richard Wollstonecraft, Count Fosco, and Pilliter for being on the show.
Thanks very much.
Pleasure, guys.
Thank you, guys.
It was maybe a slightly shorter podcast, but sometimes shorter is sweeter. And go out and see this film, everybody. It can be even just be a metaphor of being red-pilled in many ways. So go check it out.